Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined by Amy Bernstein, editor of Harvard Business Review. Starting out at CBS, she joined US News and World Report, where she quickly rose through the ranks to become assistant managing editor. With a clear passion for business journalism, she went on to hold editorial positions at Brill's Content, The Industry Standard, and Business 2.0. She moved out of journalism in 2005, joining consultancy Booz Allen, where she was managing editor of their in-house magazine and developed their thought leadership. She held a similar role at Manpower Group, where she had the fascinating title of Vice President of Global Thought Leadership. Now editor of Harvard Business Review, she's not only responsible for developing content for the website and print magazine, but also helps position its editorial brand. Amy, thank you for joining me.
Delighted to be here, Paul.
A lot of people say when I flatter them about that intro and how impressive it is, that it's, you know, it looks like a narrative in kind of retrospect. Did you always want to be a journalist? Did you always know, were you always really ambitious? Did you always want to be editor of Harvard Business Review?
Oh my goodness, no. I had no idea what I wanted to do, especially when I was in college. I thought I wanted to teach high school girls Latin and Greek. That was my great ambition. I was going to go off to graduate school, get my doctorate, and march off into the academic future.
Teaching people Greek? I mean, that's pretty and clever.
Well, talk about jumping into a shrinking pool. Yeah. Definitely.
So how did you get your first moves into journalism then? What changed?
I graduated from college into 10% unemployment in my cohort with my degree in Latin and Greek, which meant I was qualified for absolutely no job. A friend of a friend helped me get an introduction to the CBS News election unit. This was in advance of a midterm election. It was 1982. I was hired to be a clipper, which I don't even think there are clippers anymore. My job was to cut articles out of newspapers from across the country.
Physically cut them.
Using a scissors, or I got a special clipping tool. I'd never seen one of those before. And then make scores of copies for all of CBS News's political reporters and producers and distribute them. So that really kind of turned me on to journalism. And once you get it, you get the bug. And I absolutely fell in love with it. And I loved being at CBS News in New York City. You know, it felt like we were at the center of the universe. It was the glory days of the Dan Rather era. And I moved along through special events, did a lot of special bulletins, the Challenger disaster, the Achille Lauro hijacking, TWA 847. This is a list of disasters from the early and mid-80s that I participated in covering.
But your adrenaline must have been going. I mean, the sheer spectacle of and the intrigue of being a journalist there to be able to tell the news.
Oh, it was... I became such an adrenaline junkie. It was so heady to be in the newsroom when the entire nation or even the world was focused on one event, a presidential election, you know, some kind of disaster, awful as those are. There was something about being in the center of it, watching events unfold, being there as they're being analyzed and interpreted. I couldn't get enough of it.
So you knew at that point that you were going to be a journalist for life?
I hoped to be. It was also a period when CBS and the other broadcast networks were laying off their own journalists by the hundreds. So I would have been pretty arrogant to think I could have done it for the rest of my life, but I sure hope to.
It is a problem, isn't it? Because as you've just correctly pointed out there, the number of journalists in newsrooms is dwindling hugely across newsrooms around the world.
Mm-hmm. It's been going on for so long, and the consequences, I mean, just take it out of the question of personal career path, the consequences for the loss of all of that critical judgment and that drive to ask why and to seek proof and to connect the dots and to speak truth to power is dire. So, yeah, I'm pretty concerned about that, along with everyone else in the world, so...
But you've got quite a unique take on it. And of course, in your position, you must see the increased prevalence of people like me, PR people, who, you know, a lot of we get when I advertise for jobs, I get a lot of ex-journalists applying. You know, mm-hmm. It seems to be a lot of the career now that you do 20 years in a newsroom, get redundancy, and then you come and join people like us.
Well, I think that everyone deserves to get their story out, and every learning how to tell your story well is an art, and it's a skill, and having help doing it from people like you, that's great. What I worry about is what I see as a loss of critical judgment, where viewers and readers, although mostly viewers and listeners, can't tell the difference between journalism and advocacy. That's where I get concerned.
And why do you think that is? Do you think they've not been taught the critical thinking skills in school? Do you think it's that the media have become much more savvy in terms of fewer journalists? They're looking for clickbait. They're looking for traffic at all costs. What is the mix that's driven that?
I think it's probably everything you've just said. You know, I can't speak to the schools. I'm not there anymore and I don't have children. But I do think that we don't do much long thinking. We do everything in such tiny snatches, such tiny bites of information. And I'm really just thinking out loud. And so much of our information is paid for that I think that we don't see the bright line anymore between advocacy and journalism. But I'd really have to give that a little bit more thought. And I'm not sure that people see the value in the difference always.
Which is even more worrying, frankly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, we will allow you to meditate on that throughout the podcast. We'll come back to it if we can. Let's go back to your career then. So what came next?
So after CBS News, it was after another, there were probably half a dozen huge layoffs in my first 5-6 years there. And I kept watching people walk out the door, you know, kind of hopeless, thinking they'd never get their next job. They were all, you know, late 40s, early 50s. And I thought, wow, if that isn't a crystal ball, I don't know what is. So I thought, let me go find myself a job that at least is secure and stable.
Yeah, because even though you managed to stay, you're looking at them walk out the door. You're thinking I could be next.
Well, I managed to stay partly because I worked really hard and I was very cheap. So, you know, that helps. But when you're watching people doing the job you long to do, losing the job because they just age out and the world is saying, no, we can't afford this anymore, you need to pay attention. So I thought law school would be the answer. I went and worked in a law firm for 6 months, found that law school would not be the answer. And through someone I knew, someone I'd worked for at CBS News, I found a job at U.S. News and World Report, which is one of the three, which at the time was one of the three leading news weeklies in the United States. And I went there and had the good fortune to work with really brilliant editors who were incredibly generous with their time and their wisdom and would let me sit at their elbow and ask dumb questions about every change they made in the copy. And that's how I learned to edit. I was not a good reporter. I had to go through the reporting step, but when someone would answer my question with a none of your business or leave me alone, you know, my response was always like, oh, okay, fine. You're right. Didn't mean to be intrusive. So yeah. Clearly
not,
I wasn't
the killer instinct of a journalist.
I have the killer instinct when I'm telling others to do things, but I don't have it myself.
You're an editor. You're a classic editor. I can see that now.
Totally that way. And when I saw what editing was about, I thought, well, that is the job for me.
So you knew straight away there was a light bulb moment.
Oh, absolutely. And I have loved it ever since. I've been doing it for, as an editor, I've been doing it for about 25 years, and I absolutely love it. There's a real kind of a thrill that I get out of helping people say what they're trying to say and say it better and connect with a readership.
And it's not just that, of course, because the role of editor is about shaping the content itself, not just merely commissioning the actual articles, but the whole tone, the whole editorial approach.
Absolutely, the
book stops with you.
Yeah, oh, yeah, it does. And it's, just jumping forward a few decades, what we do at Harvard Business Review can be so consequential. People make business decisions based on what they read in our magazine. They make important decisions about their own careers based on what they read. So I really feel that, you know, if one of my initial impulses about journalism was that it would help me make the world a better place, this, to me, has even more impact because we do help people run their businesses better, make smarter long-term decisions. We bring the smartest thinking from the people who really understand management and leadership and business to the people who are leading businesses. That's a pretty great place to play.
Do you feel that sense of responsibility? I mean, I've been a long-time reader of HBR. I'm a huge fan.
Yeah, I do feel a sense of responsibility.
Because it is the magazine globally, is it? I mean, I don't think there's anything bigger.
No, I mean, there aren't many that do what we do. No, I feel a huge sense of responsibility. It's a 93-year-old publication that was Harvard Business Review way before I got there and will continue to be right there at the top of the mountain after I leave. So I feel like, you know, I do have a responsibility.
Can you see you in it now, though, as editor, in terms of the changes you've made?
Sure, I can, but I'm sensitive to the small things that I think, the small details that make a great package, which is what magazine editing involves. What was there way before I got there and will continue after me is a level of brilliance and insight and thoughtfulness that has always been the hallmark of Harvard Business Review.
Well, let's go back to your career after this, but let's focus on HBR for the moment then, because tell us how you put a typical issue, you know, to bed. Take us through the whole process in terms of start to finish.
Well, let me start with how we program it, you know, how we make our decisions about content. The meat and potatoes of our offering is in the features, the feature well. So the middle of the magazine where we have the classic long form, rigorously argued and researched big idea about management, leadership, innovation, business, those type of topics. And we start by picking what we call our spotlight story and our spotlight topic. And we have stations of the cross that we touch every year, and they have to do with innovation and leadership, but occasionally one will come along where we're hearing or we're picking up growing interest among the people who we're trying to reach, organizational leaders. So design thinking would be an example. Innovation, always. We are about to close an issue about ecosystem innovation. That's a word we're hearing a lot more. We put together a bunch, you know, three, let's say, articles on the topic. One might be an interview with a business leader. The main article will be a big thought piece with the research underneath it, probably from one of the leading lights of business thinking, management thinking. And then we program against that, because what we strive to do in every issue is to be relevant to everyone. So if we have an article about innovation, that probably touches on not just innovation, but it will touch on strategy and business models. So then we want something that will hit people who don't deal with that every day. So maybe a marketing article, maybe an article about something that has to do with operations. You know, it kind of depends on what's available to us. What, you know, it takes months to develop these articles.
But different takes.
Different takes, and with an eye toward a balance of relevance to our varied readers, high level versus very practical, a balance across disciplines and regions and industries. We know, our readers tell us that if one article is relevant to them, the issue is worth it, right? And that's and we strive to do that. The front of the book is where we showcase new ideas coming out of academia. That we program similarly. We usually pick the big article at the beginning, which is like a mini feature, a new idea that hasn't exactly proved itself out yet, but we have a lot of reason to think it will. And then we try to achieve a similar balance for the next few pages. The back of the book is called Experience, and that's really where...
It's my favorite bit.
And it's sort of dessert, right? After a big meal. So the Experience section is really focused on you. Right, the professional who's trying to grow and learn and achieve. So and it's got an academic take on your career, but also we look at the books and other media you should be reading and help you figure out, you know, what's good and worth your time. We always have a wonderful interview with someone of great accomplishment from outside the business world on the last page. We call that life's work. You know, it's where I would say we have evolved is I would say that we're a bit more engaging now as a magazine, and that started with Adi Ignatius, who joined the magazine, joined HBR about 8, 9, 10 years ago and really revamped the approach, really made it more of a magazine rather than a sort of loosely connected group of articles bound together.
It used to feel quite like an academic journal, but now It does feel very much like a magazine.
Yeah.
That's not too trite a thing to say.
Well, it's supposed to, and I'm really glad you feel that way. That was Adi's, I think, great accomplishment was to make that very big change, you know, to take the table of contents off the cover and to make the magazine more engaging and, you know, even sometimes delightful.
But the seriousness, the kind of academic rigor and the robustness that when I read articles in it, I know these people have given it some serious thought and they're very respected. It's good that you've not lost that in the design and the approachability, because whilst I also love Inc. and Fast Company and all of the other business magazines, you go to HBR, I would say, for some serious thinking on this topic. You want to solve the problem, so what is the top thinking? I don't want to be... I'm already inspired to succeed at that point by some other magazines. Now it's right, what do I need to do?
Right, well, that's where we're different from everyone else. And there aren't that many playing in our field, but I think that we own that field. We are cognizant. I mean, I worry about TED and I worry about LinkedIn and, you know, all the titles you've mentioned, because they do a good job of finding interesting ideas as well. Our ideas have been tested. You know, they come from the right people. You've got to be a recognized and accomplished leader in your field to be published in our magazine. And there has to be evidence that your idea works.
How communicative are your readers with you? I know since you've changed the approach, and how well do you know them? How well do you communicate them? Is that information?
We know them pretty well. Well, we talk to them. We initiate the conversation a lot. And then we have a fabulous website, HBR.org, where we really get a kind of day-to-day give and take with them. We do a lot of, we're really expanding our digital presence. So we have Facebook Live and we have a lot of podcasts, and we hear from our community a lot based on that.
I met Eric Hellweger. I spoke with him on a panel about 10 years ago. And I kept in touch with him from time to time. Delightful chap.
Wonderful
guy.
At
the top of his game.
Yeah.
And doing really, really well. So I've kind of kept in touch with the innovations and developments on the HBR. Followed it with a keen interest.
Yeah. So Eric is one of the people behind all of those changes. So we pay a lot of attention to our readers. And we also recognize that they're different and they have different needs. And, you know, not everyone is sitting in the C-suite. And we're serving people sort of across a spectrum of organizational leadership and management.
Do they all aspire to the C-suite, even if they're not yet there?
I don't know. I mean, I think many people do, because that's human nature.
Well, I mean, I personally want nothing less than global domination and anything I can learn.
Well, and that's clearly in your future.
Exactly. But yeah. If I can learn some techniques and some methodologies from the magazine, then it's proved very, very useful. I do agree with you as well, actually, that when this happens with a lot of magazines, that you're actually looking for maybe one or two things to take away from the whole thing that are going to stick with you rather than trying to go for lots of B and C list level type stuff.
Yeah, I mean, we're not entertainment. People don't read us for, you know, just to pass the time. They come to us with a purpose. I mean, we know, for example, that our readers, and this is the magazine, come to us at the end of their day and on weekends, and they really put aside time to read us. I see people reading us on on airplanes when they have quiet time, because the life of a, you know, when if our readers tend to be managers and to run parts of organizations or whole organizations, they don't have a whole lot of time to read. So when they pick up one of our magazines, they are doing it with the intent of sitting down, clearing away all the other distractions, and focusing.
But you must be, as editor, quite flattered and incredibly gratified by the power of that attention that they give you. I mean, yesterday I relaxed for half an hour in my hotel room and I went on BuzzFeed and Crack.com and it was enjoyable, but I could not tell you what I read. I remember being moderately amused for half an hour, but that's not the same when you read an issue of HBR.
Right. You're not going to be moderately amused.
Yeah, well,
maybe you will be. I think our writing is good. But you will probably take a few notes and start thinking about how you do what you do and how you might want to change how you do what you do. You might walk out of, you might close the magazine having finished an article, thinking differently about what you do.
All the time.
And how you comport yourself and what you're trying to accomplish.
And you alluded to it earlier, actually, mentioned it briefly, about that responsibility that you have as editor, but also the responsibility of someone as an Augusta journal, as HBR, that what you do does change lives, change business decisions, investment, layoffs, whether an idea is going to be pursued. Does that rest heavy on your shoulders sometimes?
Well, I am aware of it, and I'm really proud of it, and it makes decision-making pretty easy. I mean, when we are deciding on an article idea, I mean, it better be a service. We better believe that it will somehow enrich our readers and help them in some way. So it does give us a compass to guide us through the decision-making process. If I thought about it too much, it might paralyze me. So
yeah,
the truth is, I can't. But
it's the golden rule of tightrope walking, isn't it? Just never look down and you're all right.
You just never look down. But we have such a good pipeline and of really smart ideas. And people want to appear. Academics want to appear in our magazine. Business leaders want to appear in our magazine. There is an imprimatur of some value there for them. So we are lucky. Then the decision making can be, we have to say no to people we love sometimes.
You must say no to quite a lot of people, because a lot of people you must get a lot of inbound requests.
We say no a lot. And one of the challenges of saying no, and I do it a lot myself, is you have to have a reason. So you're constantly thinking about your rationale. You're constantly articulating principles for why this article does or doesn't work. And whenever I have a kind of, gut instinct about something, I know that I have to think about why I'm reacting that way and then question it. So there are very few easy calls. And I'm constantly asking people, what's new here? And why does this matter? And how do you know this? So there's usually a conversation before there's even a decision.
So just to touch on that before we move on to something else, though, because in a sense, you're not short of topics like, say, an editor of a newspaper would be with it, if nothing's happened that day. For example, in the in Great Britain, where I'm from, we call it silly season in the summer when courts and parliament are closed. Newspapers will run anything, really, because the sources of news are shut.
Yeah, it happens here too.
But I was actually going to say, does it happen at HBR in a sense? Because what you've got is that new thinking. Do you ever get to cover a certain industry and then you think, actually, there hasn't been much new thinking this year than there was, say, last year?
Well, our ideas, we like to think they're timeless and timely, but they tend not to be tied to events. So we aren't subject to those vicissitudes, right? There are, certain fashions for articles, for ideas that, that come out of the reality of business and its evolution. So, there's no shortage of ideas floating around out there about serving the underserved. Bottom of the pyramid type thinking. There's no shortage of ideas about digital transformation and its impact. Internet of Things, for example. Starting to see a lot about artificial intelligence. And so our task is to figure out how these insights differ from the insights we've already offered our readers about big data, for example, and the Internet of Things. So we have that. We have the evolution of business and operations and the impact of megatrends like the growth of technology, the growth of, you know, personal technology, millennials in the workforce, though a lot of people think that's a lot of hooey. Our ideas are shaped and grow out of those, but they're not subject to what happens, you know, tomorrow in Parliament and, you know, the presidential election in November.
I imagine if people want to know about the presidential election or today in Parliament, they're going to look to other news sources, aren't they? That's not your job. You've got
That's
a niche
our
and
job.
You're delivering it.
On the other hand, HBR.org will give you an HBR perspective on the election. We HBR don't have an opinion, but we will bring you the smartest insights from business and management thinkers on the impact of the election. You know, what a Trump presidency would mean, what a Hillary Clinton presidency would mean. That we would do. We would not do that in the magazine.
Sometimes when I'm reading the magazine, although I'm offered business insights, they're actually profound insights into life itself and dealing with other human beings. You can talk about, you know, how to motivate people and how to get best practice out of your staff, but you could turn that into your own home. And, you know, I've learned some things where I think, well, I can learn this lesson and apply it more widely.
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of what we have published about humility and leadership, for example, is very important, about authenticity, what it means and how you deal with it. The kind of insights we provide into leading teams are useful at home.
Yes. Well, it's a different team.
You know, for what I look for, though, is the kind of our what I love is sort of genuine new insight. What I have a little bit of an allergy to is the cynical repackaging of hackneyed insight.
Of old insight, yeah.
Yeah. And there is a lot of that out there, you know. But, you know, the way we've gone from a command and control environment in most organizations to a much flatter environment. And in fact, much business gets done outside the organization through loose partnerships of various sorts. So how do you get people working toward the same goal? This is a management challenge that is old as management itself, but it does change with the changing context. And I think those are sort of, there are life lessons in those.
Are there any particularly strong lessons that you've learned in the editor's chair, both about the job and doing the job, in terms of the content that you've covered that have stuck with you?
Yeah, well,
as long as you like to answer that one, because I'd be fascinated.
Well, one I learned from one of my favorite editors, Michael Ruby, who was the editor-in-chief of U.S. News and World Report, co-editor with his wife, Merrill McLaughlin, that two of the most brilliant editors I've ever worked with. And Mike had a very simple rule about editing, which I think about every day. And it's, before you make a change, ask yourself, are you making it better or are you making it different? That is a rule. That is the rule I live by as an editor when I'm dealing with copy. In managing people, some of the things I think about that I've really had to learn is doing it my way isn't the important thing. It's getting it done and doing it right. And I've learned to let people do things their way. You know, I used to draw a map for how to get from here to there, and I don't think that's usually that useful. I still do it every now and then when we have to get there pretty quickly. But most of the time, I don't really care how you get from here to there, as long as you do it in a way that doesn't cast a bad light on all of us. I don't have time to micromanage, but it also doesn't help everyone. I really want the people who work in my part of the for the entire organization to be as happy to come in every morning as I am, and to feel as proud of what they do as I do. So I've learned to be a little bit hands off, because I work with a wonderful, wonderful team of extremely talented and seasoned editors, designers, and production experts.
And what on the business side as well? I mean, you are, you know, you're literally the repository of the cutting edge business thinking of the world. I'm envious of that because I would think, well, I'm an entrepreneur. I could start 5 businesses within 6 months of doing your job because I would have got the insight, everything I need to know, all of the kind of back channel stuff, and then I could go and do it. You've never been tempted?
Yeah. You know, I often wonder, do we eat our own dog food? You know, we are a very successful media company, and there aren't many media companies that can say that. We have a really smart team of business leaders. We're a diversified media company, and I think that the wisdom of their decisions shows in the health of our operations.
It's inspiring as well how you guys haven't had this kind of race to the bottom that a lot of iconic media brands have had, where they're now given out free at metro stations and tube stops. You know, I buy HBR on the newsstand and it's expensive, and I like that.
Yeah. it is expensive.
It should be expensive.
Well, one of the things is, you know, we know not to stake our future on advertising revenue. We can't. And what we are serving is immensely valuable. So you should be paying for it.
Anyway, I rudely interrupted you there because you were about to tell me these hidden bits of pearls of wisdom that I can then monetize.
Oh, my pearls of wisdom. What else can I tell? I mean, I'm not sure you can monetize any of this, but, you know, I've learned about, I used to not care what the readers thought, and now I care an awful lot.
Can you tell who's going places, names that you know, that you can say that 10 years from now, he or she will be a serious player, they're well on the way? Is there something that, you know, when you're covering certain sectors or certain people where you think, right, this is going to be the next big thing?
Well, rather than name names, I'll tell you companies that I pay a lot of attention to because they do seem to, get out in front a lot, and they seem to shape the conversation more than other companies. So IDEO would be an example of one of those companies. Mm. Apple, for a long time, was one of those companies. I'm not sure right now that it is. GE, I can't turn away from GE. What they have done to transform themselves with their digital platform and the way they are connecting their businesses is really fascinating. And they're so disciplined as a company. Unilever, the Paul Polman insistence that he has put values and sustainability and making the planet healthier at the center of his strategy is fascinating. You know, those are the companies, and there are others. Natura out of Brazil, an interesting skincare product company. Some of the companies that are starting to emerge out of Africa are interesting.
We have a client that's very active in Africa, and I've been out there many times. And the sheer entrepreneurial culture and how ingrained it is. You know, if you go in Dar es Salaam or if I was in Uganda recently, it's absolutely amazing.
Yeah, and the creativity, the energy, a lot of smarts. And these are people who are these entrepreneurs are dealing with unusual constraints, unusual to Western business leaders. And they figure it out. There's a lot to learn from them. I think that a lot of what's going on in India is fascinating. The kind of reverse engineering you see coming out of emerging economies like India, with such intelligence, such an eye to the market. Of course, you know, a number of the Chinese players are, you know, Tencent, for example, fascinating. Alibaba, fascinating. Alibaba and Amazon are playing similar games, it seems, and you know, playing by a similar playbook. They're not playing games by any stretch. So yeah, no, there are certain businesses that I pay a lot of attention to because they seem to be super smart about making strategic bets. And any strategic bet is a bet on the future. And we live in a time of such complexity and such murkiness. You know, we don't know what's going to happen. And it seems like it's because everything happens so quickly and it can be so dramatic and there's so many externalities at play. I'm in awe of those leaders who can make bold and decisive moves, knowing that if they allow themselves to be paralyzed, their organizations will sink.
Are you personally still fascinated by business?
Oh,
well?
Yeah.
If that's not too trite a question.
More so than ever. More so than ever. I mean, it's where all of human endeavor kind of meets, right? Well, not all, but much. It's the drama of it, the brilliance of it. There's so much at stake. I love the creativity. Yeah, I'm totally turned on by it.
Can you see when things go wrong, the kind of commonalities, whether it be pride or whether it just be the wrong timing or underinvestment in a certain aspect of the service? When I read about business failures, it tends to be often different manifestations of the same thing, really. I read a book many years ago called How They Blew It, and it was a kind of anti-biography of sort of, and not done in a kind of, you know, in a sneering way, but like, here's 10 failures and this is what they did wrong. And I actually got quite a lot out of that because you know not to do that.
Yeah, you know, I really, really started to see that was when I was at the Industry Standard, which was one of the magazines based in San Francisco during the internet boom of, say, 1998 to 2001. And it was a great, great magazine, partly because it was never in the pocket of any of the startups. It really took a very gimlet-eyed journalistic view of what was going on out there. Great editor in Jonathan Weber. And, you know, we covered the rise of the internet economy, and it went straight up at a mind-blowing velocity, and then it came plummeting down. And as it came plummeting down to the ground, we kept seeing the same problems over and over again. You know, this notion that, you know, negative gross margins, that somehow that scale would solve that problem. Well, that's ridiculous. We saw that the physics of business always applies, even when it's digital business. So, you know, there's that whole category of thinking you're rewriting the rules of business because you're using different kinds of platforms and different kinds of technology.
But you still need money in the bank at the end of the month to pay your staff's wages.
Well, your operations still have to throw off enough money to do that, right?
Exactly.
I mean, that's just pretty basic stuff. You know, yeah, I there are way more lessons. I mean, this is a truism of what I do, but there are profound lessons in failure. And the wisest leaders have all failed at some point. I'll just throw that out there and then I'll think about it later and wish I hadn't said it. But I think that there's a lot to that, that you gain humility, you gain wisdom, you see where you tend to put a foot wrong, but you also see where wishful thinking can't overcome reality, right? So, yeah, I mean, I do have to say that I wouldn't, I you know, I had one little business once, and you see that I don't run a business. So, I mean, just because I cover business doesn't mean I know how to run a business. One of the things that fascinates me right now is the discipline of business experimentation. How do you know? I mean, everyone is always trying to innovate their way to faster, higher growth. How do you know when to cut off an experiment, how to learn from it? How do you put it in a box and pick out the valuable parts? That kind of interests me because innovation is such an important part of any organization's future. And there's a lot of failure in that, but smart companies seem to have made a kind of have developed a discipline around that so that it isn't failure with a capital F, get out of here, go find another job. It's after action reviews that reveal wisdom that can be put to use in the next experiment. The whole question of failure, I think, is forcing us to rethink. I think that the way business is being done now is forcing us to rethink failure, what that means, and to see value in it.
I have colleagues that have, you know, kind of embraced failure. They say, look, my mistakes are custom designed, very painful lessons just designed just for me so that I can learn from them. I personally, you still have to kind of feel the bad feelings, don't you?
But, oh, yeah.
But you can remove the toxicity out of it. I mean, if you're failing, it means you're trying things. And I also think if you're not prepared to try things, if you're paralyzed by indecision and inertia and this kind of committee group thing, you know, you're never going to fail if you never try anything.
That drives me crazy is hearing that we can't do such and such because we've never done such and such.
Yes.
Or that's the way we do things. Well, you know, sometimes you have to ask yourself if that's the right way to do things. And you know, of course, we always deal with that. And there's always a burden of tradition. but if you're lucky enough to survive past a few years. And you need those traditions, because you should, if you have to make a big decision every time you want to put one foot in front of the other, managerially speaking, you're never going to get anywhere, right? You need ways of doing things, but periodically you have to ask whether they're the right ways of doing things, if that is still true. What I find really interesting about, one of the ways that I think the internet economy is such as has change the way we think about business and digitization and the kind of the speed of innovation and the speed of evolution has changed the way we think about business is that there is a way to wear failure gloriously. It used to be when I first got into the world of media, you know, if you lost your job, you might as well just go to law school after all. You know, just go because your name is mud. But now everyone has been through some kind of disruption. Everyone has been laid off, or my goodness, I would say that I've ridden several magazines to the bottom of the ocean. So I shouldn't say that out loud. But I hope that what one develops is the ability to separate a good idea that didn't do well from one's personal. It's not a referendum on you. You have to be able to shake it off. You really do. You have to be able to say, okay, it's not working. Here's what I've learned from it. Let's all agree that this is what we've learned from it. And let's move along. I do spend some time saying to people, it's okay. You know, it was an honest mistake. We'll live.
And failure can be a very positive event if it stops, like insofar as if it's a defined failure event, at least it stops it not being an ongoing failure. I've spoken to colleagues that have said, my business wasn't doing so well and I asked the bank for a loan and the best thing they ever did was turn me down because it meant I had to close it down and re-engineer the business. And had they lent the money, it would only have prolonged the agony. So in a sense, at least failure brings closure to that process.
Well, it's one of the things I like about business is that you have to be gimlet-eyed and straightforward and ask those tough questions. If you're just going to be nice and if you're afraid that someone's not going to like you if you ask a tough question, you're not going to achieve much, right? But forcing people to think hard about their proposals and their ideas is going to elevate everyone, right? It's going to improve whatever it is you're thinking about.
We've only got a few minutes left, actually, so I've just got a couple more questions, mm-hmm. if I may. But I did want to say, because I know you said that you're not in business, but you have been in consultancy, so you have been out of journalism and into the kind of real world, if I can call it that, of consultancy. Did you enjoy that? Has it changed the way that you edit now, for example?
It's helped me understand how business leaders think. It was a really great experience, and I really needed it. Didn't even know I needed it until I got it. Because I joined the group that were my readers before, I learned the patterns of thinking. I learned about priorities. I learned concepts that I had never even thought about. As an editor, we all always strive for perfection. But in business, you have to embrace an idea of good enough that maybe that, you know, the extra 10% of effort is going to be very costly but isn't going to give you much return because your target market doesn't care about it. So I do think about that sometimes, which isn't to say we're not always still striving for brilliance and excellence. But, you know, at some point you have to say enough, we're going to send that page. It was boot camp. I got thrown in to the proverbial deep end of the pool in a couple of those jobs. I had no idea what it meant to size a market, for example, when I was told to go do that. I had no idea how to figure out the competitive landscape in creating a business. I learned some of that. I won't say that I necessarily enjoyed it because I don't like doing things badly. And man, was I bad at it at the beginning, at least. But, you know, I had to learn. In fact, I went to HBR to learn a lot of this stuff. So I got an appreciation of HBR as a vital tool for anyone in a business leadership role, a management role. And it really burnished HBR in my mind because I relied on it so heavily when I was so desperate for some knowledge and understanding about what I was being tasked to do.
What's the career path for kind of ex-editors of HBR? I mean, you've got the what I would consider one of the best jobs in the world, hugely enjoyable, hugely influential, as you've already mentioned, how you really enjoy going to work on the morning and you know that it's going to be a good day. But what happens to people like you? What do they do next? Do they pivot and cover some entirely different thing? I mean, because you can't get a better job in business journalism. You're already editor of HBR. Do you become editor of a veterinary magazine or something? What happens?
Well, I'm looking at some of my predecessors, and they've gone on to a variety of roles. Some have become sort of eminences in their own right, columnists. Bill Taylor, he went on to found Fast Company, and he writes books, and he's a very important thinker on the sort of business and management front. People do a variety of things. I don't know what, I mean, if I wonder what I would do after this, what I will do after this. And, you know, I guess some folks write books.
But presumably, if you don't mind me asking a very personal question, you're in no rush to leave, aren't you? You're very well respected. You're doing a great job. Why would you want to make a change?
Well, I'm enjoying it. I'm in no rush to leave. I would love to stick around and continue. I'll tell you, I get up in the morning really, really happy to be doing what I'm doing. And I haven't always felt that way about every job I've had. So I feel incredibly lucky to have been working for so long and to feel so excited to start my day every day.
We have a lot of young people, aspiring journalists, listening to this podcast. What advice would you give to someone in their early 20s that's starting out a career in journalism that is listening to this thinking, I want to be the editor of HBR in a few decades from now? What are the tidbits, what are the morsels of information, the methodologies? How can they get there?
Wow. Well, I'll tell you what I've learned and what I wish I knew, what I wish I knew when I was 21 or 22. One of them is, pay attention to what interests you and follow that. Don't force yourself to do things that don't interest you, because if that, you know, you just won't do that very well. The ideal is to do what you love. And it is absolutely possible, but you got to figure out what you love. I talked to some young folks recently who worked at HBR who's talked about, you know, sort of collecting skills. And that really puzzled me. It was such a foreign idea to me. Because it seems to me that a lot of the technical skills are very easy to pick up. It's the passion and the subject matter expertise and knowledge and wisdom and experience. You know, those are hard to come by, and they're very soft, and I don't know how you measure them. But if you can follow what interests you and put together and put one foot in front of the other in a way that where you can see a path and you can tell a good story that is a real story, not a fake story, because you'll get found out immediately. Mm. You'll get where you want to go. And anyone who says at age 21, I want to be the editor of HBR, I'm gonna have a lot of questions for that person.
Should they be immediately disqualified from that just by virtue of the skill of the ambition?
Well, no, absolutely no. You need ambition, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with ambition. Ambition is fuel, and it's drive, and you've got to have those things. What I want to know from people is what do they love? What turns them on? When I interview people for a job, I want to see their eyes light up, and that's how I get an idea of what turns people on and who I want to work with and who I think will contribute to the team.
Do you think aspiring journalists have it harder these days? Because, of course, the elephant in the room for me is that, of course, there's fewer places available for them, there's fewer jobs in newsrooms, blah, blah, blah. But in another sense, there's much more opportunity to use the internet, to use blogging, to do things on BuzzFeed, to get noticed.
Yeah, I think it's harder to be a newspaper journalist today, but I don't think it's harder to be a journalist. You know, the media landscape, the media world kind of, it kind of blew up. And there are lots of small media operations. It's going to coalesce again. That's just the way of industries. They kind of atomize and then they coalesce and they atomize and they coalesce. And we'll get back to three big somethings and then there'll be another disruption. But I think there's a lot of opportunity. I mean, it's hard to start at the New York Times. You don't get that much opportunity. But if you're starting at a small media company where they're going to give you a tremendous amount of exposure and throw you into stuff, you know, take you out of your comfort zone every week, you're going to get a lot better experience and you'll be able to move farther faster. I don't know. Yeah, it's harder to be a mainstream journalist because there's not just not that much mainstream journalism going on. But there's a lot of interesting journalism going on and a lot of opportunity out there. And so do it before you have a mortgage and kids to support. That's all I can say.
And on that note, Amy, we're running out of metaphorical tips, so we'll have to leave it there. It's been hugely enjoyable. Thank you ever so much.
Thank you for having me.
A Big Things Media production. Big Things!